Well, this month, you're helping me by allowing me to warm up for the class that I'm going to teach. It'll be a class on the first five books of the Bible, the five books of Moses, as they're called, or the Pentateuch. And so each Sunday, we're looking at a story from one of those books. Last week, we started out in Genesis, and we noticed that God has, at that time, we're talking 4,000 years ago, 3,500 to 4,000 years ago, was shaping history to solve a very important problem. And that problem was the sin of mankind, begun by Adam and Eve in the garden, and a problem that each one of us has inherited, where we have rejected God in our hearts. We might look religious sometimes, but at the core of our being, apart from the grace of God working in our lives, we are rebels against God. And we have violated His moral commandments, and we have violated His justice. And so God has shaped history in order to solve yours and my problem. And He chose a particular group of people to be a part of this solution. And the first person that was of that group of people was Abraham, where God established a relationship with Abraham and promised him that He would give to Abraham descendants, that He would give to Abraham land, and that He would use Abraham as a tool in history, an instrument of His grace and His mercy, so that all the families and nations of the earth would eventually be blessed through Abraham. And so Abraham's family started to grow ever so slowly. One son, Isaac, through whom this promise was to come. And then Isaac had two sons, and one of those sons was chosen to be the son through whom the promise would continue, that son being Jacob. And then Jacob had 12 sons, and it was through these 12 sons that the promise would continue. But one son in particular, and that was going to be Judah. But it's a interesting way that the story gets woven together, because Judah is not the focus at the end of Genesis, but Joseph is. And Joseph is a naive 17-year-old who gets his brothers really angry with him. His father, Jacob, didn't help. His father, Jacob, made the classic mistake as a parent, and he chose a favorite of his sons, and that became known to all the other sons. And so they hated, the other sons hated Joseph because their father loved Joseph more. But Joseph just added fuel to the fire, unfortunately, and the brothers finally got so angry with him that they sold him into slavery and shipped him off to Egypt at age 17. Joseph spends 10 years in the household of a man by the name of Potiphar. And Potiphar's wife must have been a very insecure woman, because she propositioned Joseph probably on a daily basis to sleep with her. And Joseph rebuffed her propositions on a daily basis, until finally one time Potiphar's wife got so angry with him that she accused him of raping her. Told that to her husband. Her husband got angry with Joseph and threw him into prison. And Joseph languished in prison for 2 years. But what's interesting is that we can assume that Joseph's theology was shaped in the midst of suffering. Suffering by being separated from his family, and suffering by being in prison. And what Joseph figured out, we find out, after he gets out of prison, and especially at the end of the story, is that God was the one who caused all that to happen to him for a very specific purpose, and that was to bring about life. Life for his family, who were fed in the midst of the famine that occurred because Joseph was made vice regent of all of Egypt, and stored up food during 7 years of plenty, and also life, because Joseph himself came to a more profound understanding of God, and that he tried to pass on to his brothers. But we left the story at the end of Genesis with Joseph dead, embalmed by the Egyptians, with instructions to his family that eventually, because he had been taught by his own father the theology that God himself had given to Abraham, that eventually the people, having these his brothers and sisters, or his brothers and his family having moved down to Egypt, that they would eventually go back up to the land of Canaan, the land that God had promised him. Exodus opens with a list of all the sons of Jacob, Joseph's brothers. What eventually happens is that God prospers the Israelites in Egypt, which was his promise. I will multiply your seed. They'll be as numerous as the stars of the heaven, God says to Abraham. And so this happens partially in Egypt, where the Israelites become very numerous. But they also become so numerous that they become intimidating to the Egyptian government. And they're also so prosperous that they're intimidating to the Egyptian government and the Egyptians. And so a new king arises, we're told, who doesn't know Joseph, doesn't realize how beneficial Joseph and his family have been to Egypt. And he's intimidated so much by their vast numbers that he wants to reduce their numbers. And this is the first major persecution of Jews in history, where the Egyptian government attempts to kill all the firstborn of the Egyptians. But God protects them, and they continue to increase in numbers. So the king of Egypt, the Pharaoh, decides that what he'll do is he'll oppress the Israelites, and thereby just beat them down, and hopefully that will make them less intimidating as a group. There is the story, which is perfect, of course, for Mom's Day, and you'll notice in your bulletins that this morning the message is entitled Exodus, Moses, and Mom. But maybe I need to apologize. This message is going to be mostly about the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. There is this wonderful little vignette in chapter 2 of Exodus, where Moses' mother, knowing that she is risking her own life after Moses is born, protects him for 3 months by hiding him in their house. But then finally, she just can't hide him anymore. He's growing too old. He's crying too much. Who knows? It could be discovered. And so she puts him in a basket and covers it's a reed basket, and she puts this basket that's covered in the Nile River. And Moses' sister stands there and watches the basket as it's hidden amongst the reeds themselves. And the daughter of Pharaoh comes down to the river to bathe. She finds the basket. Oy vey. A Jewish child is in this basket, a son, a boy, a little boy. She has, in fact, Moses' mother brought in as a nurse, who nurses Moses and helps and continues to nurture him and nourish him. And Moses ends up growing up in Pharaoh's household. Moses, though, goes out one day after he has grown up, and he's concerned about his people. It must have been told by his mom, you ain't Egyptian, you're Jewish, okay? So he goes out to observe his Jewish brethren who are being oppressed in slavery by the Egyptians. And he sees an Egyptian taskmaster beating one of his fellow countrymen. And so he looked at the Hebrew is great. It says he looks this way and he looks that way. And then he strikes the Egyptian and kills him, buries him in a shallow grave, and hopes that that's the end of the story. Next day he goes out and he sees two Israelites who are in conflict with one. They're fighting each other. And he says, no, you need to be at peace with one another. You're brothers. And one of them says, oh, are you going to kill one of us the same way you killed the Egyptian? Moses is horrified. He realizes the story is out. It's out so much that the Pharaoh tries to kill him and he has to flee. And he flees to the land of Midian and he spends 40 years there, learning how to be a humble leader as opposed to an aggressive, militaristic one. Well, this is where we want to pick up the story this morning, in Exodus chapter 2. Verse 23. And I want to just take you briefly here through God's response to the people who have been in slavery and oppression. And I'd like you to think about your own experience. You know, the more that I study the Bible, the more depressed I get. Because there's so much suffering in the stories of the Bible that after a while I just want to go, could I just have some fun? Yes. And I'm sure these people did on occasion. But we have to remember that it was 400 years prior to this that God actually promised to Abraham, your descendants will move down to Egypt and they will be enslaved and oppressed by the Egyptians. So this too is all part of God's plan as he's shaping history to bring about our salvation from our sin and from God's justice. So, verse 23, Exodus 2. Now it came about in the course of those many days that the king of Egypt died, and the sons of Israel sighed because of the bondage, and they cried out, and their cry for help because of their bondage rose up to him. I hear pages rustling. Did I not say this right? Chapter 2, verse 23, right? Okay, good. All right. Different Bibles. Oh, you have to turn the page. Okay. Well, you had the right Bible. You wouldn't have to do that. Okay, that's what it is. All right. All right. Where am I? Verse 23, starting all over again. Now, it came about in the course of those many days that the king of Egypt died, and the sons of Israel sighed because of the bondage, and they cried out. And their cry for help because of their bondage rose up to God. So God heard their groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And God saw the sons of Israel, and God took notice of them. A couple of progressions here that you need to note. First is the progression in what happens with the Israelites, and the second is the progression that happens with God. First, the progression that happens with the Israelites. Then in the midst of this bond, their bondage and enslavement and oppression, that the sons of Israel sighed. The word could also be translated groaned. It's just a low, guttural, ugh. And the word that's used in the Septuagint, the Greek translation of this, done around 200 BC, is the same word that Paul uses in Romans 8 to describe the groaning of the Holy Spirit on our part before God. That the Holy Spirit groans for us with groanings too deep for words. This is that same word here. I think it's the same idea. That as the Israelites groaned, we're going to find also that God himself groaned. And he does that for us too. As you and I groan, he groans. God's extremely empathetic, sympathetic. The word means to feel with you and me. So the first thing that the Israelites did is they sighed, they groaned, and then they cried out. As in the midst of their groaning, the groaning just became too much, and so they started crying out. But this is a relatively weak word for cried out. It's just a, God, we're hurting. In the midst of our oppression. And then the progression continues. And they cried out, and their cry for help because of their bondage rose up to God. Here the word cry I won't do it, okay? Sometimes I know I do, but I won't do it this morning. The word, I think, is better translated scream. They went from groaning to crying out to literally screaming. And that's what rose up to God. Have you ever screamed at God? Better him than at others. You might have screamed at others. You might have screamed at your wife. You might have screamed at your husband. You might have screamed at your children. You might have screamed at your coworkers. You might have screamed at your friends. But that'll crush people. I know too well I'm a screamer. And back when my sons were in high school, I decided that I needed to quit. It was an obsession, and it was ruining my family, and it was ruining me. And so I swore to myself I would never scream again, never get so angry again at anyone in my family, that I would raise my voice and they would feel my anger in the volume of my voice. And that lasted for almost 8 years. And then 2 months ago, I blew it. My younger son had just arrived home from school an hour earlier, and we got into a conversation, and I lost it when I swore that I never would. And he walked out of the house, got in his car, and drove back to school. And I don't blame him. I wouldn't want to live in a house where people scream at each other. Fortunately, we've repaired that relationship, but it's not easy, is it? That takes a while. It takes understanding, it takes forgiveness, it takes more grace than I can come up with myself. If you're going to scream, scream at God. He can handle it. And that's what the Israelites did. They screamed at him. You have got to help us. And so, verse 24, God heard their groaning. And God remembered his covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And God saw the sons of Israel, and God took notice of them. Notice the progression here. God heard. You think he doesn't? Indeed, he does. He hears all the groaning, all the crying out, all the screaming. He is a God who hears. Shema Yisrael, Moses says to the Israelites, hear, O Israel, because God is the one who ultimately is the Shema'er, the hearer. He hears, and he remembers. He remembered the covenant that he made with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. He even remembered the fact that it was he who said, my people are going to be enslaved, but I will rescue them. He remembered his promise to them that he would rescue them. And God also saw. You think you could hide from God? No. God saw everything that was going on, every beating by the taskmasters, every night of weeping on their beds, every hour that they suffered. God saw it because he's a God who sees in addition to a God who hears. And he took notice of them. The word is yada. He knew them. It's the same word that's used for sexual intimacy between a husband and a wife in the Old Testament. God was so intimately involved in their lives that he knew everything that was going on so that he understood, I think is the point that Moses is making by using this word. He understood their suffering. The next part of this story is where God meets with Moses at the burning bush in chapter 3. And I want to jump down to verse 7. After the preliminary, "Hello, I am Yahweh, and I know you're Moses, and you're standing on holy ground, please take off your sandals," God says this, another description of God as he was relating to his people, the Israelites. And the Lord said, "I have surely seen the affliction of my people who are in Egypt, and I have given heed to their cry because of their taskmasters, for I am aware of their sufferings." Notice the progression there. I have seen, I have given heed, and I'm aware. And then verse 8, "So I have come down to deliver them from the power of the Egyptians and to bring them up from that land to a good and spacious land, to a land flowing with milk and honey, to the place of the Canaanite, the Hittite, the Amorite, the Perizzite, the Hivite, and the Jebusite." Divine condescension is what God is describing here. I have come down. From my position of transcendence outside of the created reality, I have come down. And of course, ultimately we know that the greatest condescension of God was Jesus. Jesus left his position of authority in heaven with the Father, and he came down to be with his people, especially those who groan, those who cry out, those who scream at God for deliverance and salvation from their sin, from their evil, from their anger, which is so misappropriate, from their lust, from their envy, from their greed, from their impatience, from their frustration, from their pride. That Jesus came down to save people like you and me. And notice how God says it here. For the Israelites, it was to bring them up to the land of Canaan because it's north of Egypt. Up in the Middle East is north, down is south. For you and me, up is heaven. Jesus has come down to take us up to heaven. Verse 9, "Now behold," if I could retranslate this from the New American Standard, if you don't mind, "the scream of the sons of Israel has come to me. Furthermore, I have seen the oppression with which the Egyptians are oppressing them." Notice how often the word "see" is used. See, see, see. God is the God of seeing and hearing the scream. There's that famous painting. Do you know it? Which one I'm talking about? Edvard Munch, the Norwegian, yeah, "The Scream." It was stolen, unfortunately, I remember, 4 years ago. The Norwegian authorities are still looking for it. But it shows a disfigured person with his hands over his ears standing on a bridge, and there's a bright red sky behind him. Painted in 1893, the painting has become the icon of all those who point to the atrocities and horrific events of the 20th century as the very description of humanity. But deep down inside, everyone is screaming. So verse 10. Therefore now, I will send you to Pharaoh, God says to Moses, so that you may bring my people, the sons of Israel, out of Egypt. And then there's this dialogue between Moses and God about, am I really qualified? And God says, and I love this statement, just one more time here, verse 12, I will be with you. Remember, this was what was said three times about Joseph. Once he'd been sold into slavery, and then even in prison, God was with him. This is what you and I need every moment of our lives, or we're toast. I am with you, God says, no matter how much suffering you're enduring. And then in verse 16, just want to touch on this, we'll where God is describing himself once more. And he says to Moses, go and gather the elders of Israel together and say to them, the Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, has appeared to me saying, I am indeed concerned about you and what has been done to you in Egypt. This word that gets translated in the New American Standard, I am indeed concerned about you. First of all, it's two words put together, the same word, to show the emphasis that God is saying here. But it's a word, its basic meaning is visit. Surely I have visited you. But the word can have two different connotations, each one on the extreme of the spectrum. In the prophets, Isaiah says about God, I will visit the earth and judge it. Where his visit is not the kind of visit that you want. That's at one extreme. But there's another kind of visit that God that you do want, and this is the kind of visit that God is speaking of here. I have visited my people in the sense that I have made close inspection of what's going on in their lives. Isn't that a lovely picture there? I have come down and visited, and I've made close inspection of what's happening in your life. That's the kind of visit that you want. Because that's the visit that's saying, and I'm deeply, deeply concerned about you. If we skip on to chapter 4, God, in telling Moses to go back to Pharaoh, says to him in verse 22, and thus you shall say to Pharaoh, thus says Yahweh, Israel's my son, my firstborn. So I said to you, let my son go that he may serve me, but you have refused to let him go. Behold, I will kill your son, your firstborn. I just want to draw your attention to this because this is one of the most important themes in the entire Bible, the Son of God. Notice what God says about the whole nation of Israel here. The nation of Israel is the Son of God. My firstborn, in fact. And in the ancient Near East, the notion of firstbornness was a notion of preeminence within the family. The firstborn son got double the inheritance of all the other sons. So if there were two sons, the firstborn got two-thirds of the inheritance, and the second son got one-third. If there were seven sons, the first son got two-eighths of the inheritance, and all the other sons got one-eighth. So the notion of firstbornness is a very important notion to describe preeminence. And what God is saying here about Israel, the Jews, the nation of Israel, is that they are the preeminent people of the world. And I think that's still true. But it's through one particular Jew that preeminence remains in effect. The Son of God. Jesus. And belief in that Jew, whereby both Jews and Gentiles are incorporated into the nation of Israel, so to speak, spiritually speaking, and acquire preeminence amongst all the peoples of the earth. If you're a believer in Jesus Christ today, you're preeminent. Because as Paul says, you are being conformed to Jesus, who is the firstborn of all creation. He's preeminent, and so are we. But please don't get a big head. It's to keep you humble, not to make you proud. And so let's end then with the people's response to all this. Moses goes back to the people of Israel in Egypt to lead them out. He announces to them all that God has said to them. In verse 31, so the people believed. So the people believed. Is that what you have done with the biblical message of the gospel of Jesus Christ? Do you hear these words from Exodus, even the very foundation of the gospel, and do they resonate in your heart so that you say, well, yes, that is what I believe. I believe that God is a God who sees, that God is a God who hears, that God is a God who has concern because he visits us and makes careful inspection of every aspect of our lives in order to rescue us from our screaming and our sin. So that, like the people here, so the people believed, and when they heard that the Lord was concerned about them, that's that same word, that God had made careful inspection of them and their lives, that he had seen their affliction, then they bowed low and worshiped. For indeed, there is no other response that is appropriate. May you scream at God at the top of your lungs and know that he hears you and loves you and saves you for all eternity. And may you bow low and ascribe to him the glory and the honor that is due only to him.